Hello, and welcome to the D&D Podcast. We're recording today, January 7, and this will be hitting iTunes and the internet on Monday, January 12. So sit back and relax. We're going to be doing some mailbag today. A little bit different change of, a little bit of a new format here. Our dauntless producer, Bart Carroll, is going to be rattling off questions to myself and my new co-host, Jeremy Crawford. Jeremy's one of our intrepid editors here at Wizards of the Coast. Why don't you introduce yourself to millions and millions of D&D players across the known planes of existence?
Hello, D&D players across all planes of existence. As Mike said, I'm Jeremy Crawford. I've been working on D&D here at Wizards for about a year and a half now.
Yep, still a new guy.
Yes.
Kind of. So you have to hire more people, so you're less of a new guy.
I feel like a seasoned new guy.
Seasoned through the trenches. With what, cilantro?
And this is the voice of Bart Carroll, on-air producer now, inserting myself after the last podcast. And if you guys are ready, we'll go straight to the questions.
Hit us with the questions.
This first question comes from Ben Tinney from Melbourne, Australia. He's very emphatic about the pronunciation.
Wait, is Melbourne, is that near Melbourne, or is it a suburb of
it is.
Melbourne?
It is Melbourne. There is no Melbourne. And this question I'm asking first because it does come up quite frequently. When you guys run skill challenges in the game, how do you make the players aware that the skill challenge has started? Do you say skill challenge, or do you let them figure out that you are going to start rolling dice and here are some skills you might keep in mind?
So I've done it both ways. I've found that the real challenge to skill challenges lies in making them, I can't think of a better way to say this, so I'll just like try to sound smart. It's making them narratively coherent. That the worst skill challenges, I'll start with the ones that seem to have not worked well, or is when it feels far too mechanical. A great example, a friend of mine was telling me he was playing the game, and they have to get past this official who's like, you know, they need a license or they need some paperwork or something in the city. And the DM says, okay, it's a skill challenge. What skills do you guys want to use? And they're like, well, what if we just bribe him? We're just going to give him 100 gold pieces. And the DM is like, okay, great. Make a diplomacy check. They make the check. They get some really high results. Like, okay, great. You give him the 100 gold pieces. You bribed him. That's one success. You need to keep going. You know, and in the narrative, I mean, that's just goofy, right? If you're reading a book where, like, you know, Conan or Fafford or someone has to, like, bribe the official, they give him the big sack of gold, and the guy takes the gold and goes, okay, now what else you got for me? You know, like, so I think that's really, it really depends on, what I've been doing lately is thinking of the skill challenge as a scene in a novel. And just like I would have been with the combat or anything else that I'm going to plan out, and just try to trace what is the action going to look like. Really trying to focus on the smaller elements that build up to the resolution. Just like in a fight, you know, the characters are battling the dragon's taking injuries, you can see it's getting slowed down, it's having these cuts and bruises, and maybe like the fighter gets knocked unconscious. There's an ebb and flow there. And to try to avoid anything that falls down onto one skill check. So what I think I would prefer to do, get back to the actual question, is it depends a little bit on how I see it fitting into the adventure. If it's something that's going to lend itself to being kind of abstract, like, you guys need to get across the Forest of Gloom, how do you want to do that? And I think in that case, I say, and this is a skill challenge. So, because I want the players to start thinking a little inventively and to start creating stuff. On the other hand, if the players, you know, if they're in Shadowdale and they're trying to visit with, like, Elminster or something like that, and I want it to be a bit more narrative and a bit more flow better, I probably wouldn't actually say it's a skill challenge. I'll just role play it out. The nice thing about that is, I think when you don't tell the players it's a skill challenge, it gives you the sort of nuke option where if the players just do something like bribe the guy or just do something really smart, you can just say that is so clever that in the narrative of the game, it makes a lot of sense for the players just to get where they wanted to go. Sure, they only have 4 successes, they need 6, but, you know, telling elements to like, well, we have the map of the Dungeons of the Central Keep that you've been looking for. He's just going to say, sure, great, I'll help you guys, you know. Conversely, if there's a failure involved, I think you can do things a little more interesting when you do that where it's like, well, Elements is going to help you, but he's going to ask for a favor. Or it's not exactly the help you wanted. You know, he's going to teleport you or do the ritual, whatever, to send you where you want to go, but you're going to end up maybe, you know, instead of showing up behind the dragon and sneaking in, he's going to teleport you in front of the dragon, you know. So the players don't get this necessarily sense of, oh, failure, that means something's bad or something's stopped. It integrates itself seamlessly into the narrative. So I guess that's how I'd see it. Either you want the players to really think, oh, this is a skill challenge, let's be engaged by it, let's start making a lot of stuff up or thinking up plans, or you want them to just feel very organic. So,
and when I've been playing, some of my favorite skill challenges have been ones where I discover after the fact that we were just engaged in a skill challenge. And I think that works particularly well for extended skill challenges, because I think often people think in terms of a skill challenge that sort of plays out like a combat encounter does, which is to say in a very contained amount of time. But I think when you have a skill challenge that maybe spans over several days in the characters' lives, and perhaps there are other kinds of encounters that are injected into a skill challenge. And I just put that out there as a reminder to people. You can have these extended skill challenges that go on for days, particularly a part of like a long overland trek.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot of fun to get to the end of that trek, and maybe there have been some combat encounters on the way, to discover that because of, you know, the nature check, you know, we made 2 days ago, and you know, we did a perception check and we found the goblin's tracks and several other checks we made that, hey, we succeeded at this skill challenge. And we never needed to be told, hey, a skill challenge has begun.
Yeah.
Because we were just playing and, you know, we were using our character's abilities and role-playing our way through the narrative of the game.
Yeah.
All right, if I might ask a follow-up question then on skill challenges from Matthias Schaefer, I believe is pronounced. What was the rationale for the errata, or the update, as we're now calling them, to lower the skill challenge DCs?
So the big impetus there was to make, to sort of level the playing field. The one thing that we're still sort of trying to get right, to be blunt, is you want...
We're always right.
Well, yeah, I wish. I really hope. God. Life would be a lot easier if we were.
To be more right.
Yeah. Exactly. We just change what right means.
Can I even just had that like at home with my wife, I think I'd be happy. I mean, never mind work. But even with a dog, if I could be more right, I mean, with a dog, whatever. Anyway, the thing with the DCs that's really tricky is it comes down to, let's say if I'm playing a rogue and I have a 20 dexterity and I have the stealth skill trained, and I take a couple feats to boost my stealth checks. Should that guy feel like I am breezing through every check you throw at me? I am a ninja. I am so super stealthy. It doesn't matter. I am always going to succeed. Or do you want that guy to feel threatened? And the issue was the first set of DCs sort of said, let's make that guy feel challenged on the high end. The problem is that made people on the low end, they just couldn't do it. And now you sort of see the reverse. Well, okay, the DCs have gone down. So the guy who's just kind of like, you know, Chumley, the guy who has like an 8 dex and is trying to hide, has a chance to succeed. But now the ninja guy is just, why am I bothering rolling? My modifier is higher than the DC. So that's really the sweet spot. You know, I think looking back, the mistake we made was we should have been more descriptive in what those DCs represented.
Right.
Instead of like saying, well, these are now the DCs and just use these. Because that was the thinking behind it, but I don't think people saw that, and I think rightfully would say, well, hey, this is too easy. And part of it, too, is the other piece that goes along with it is that when you're making a skill challenge and you're using these DCs, they do allow you to be a lot more aggressive in saying everyone has to make a stealth check. Or, you know, the guy who's super stealthy, he gets to shine by just knocking out every success on these checks, but it does mean you don't want your entire challenge to rest on one skill. If the entire skill is sneak past the guard, if the entire challenge is sneak past the guards, just keep making stealth checks, that guy's going to ace it. And if he's the only one making the check, everyone else is assisting, that's no problem. So really, the key there is to look at making, you know, going for more skills, making more situations where people can't aid each other, or you know, everyone has to make the check and things like that. So that is my advice right now, you know, as far as those DCs. That was really the thinking on it. And really, at the end of the day, it comes down to what you want out of the challenge for your specific group. I mean, obviously, I don't see the DCs as canonical in the sense of that is what the number must be. I see it more as the starting point.
Right.
But that doesn't excuse any imprecision that leads to you guys, like, you know, gamers out there going, this just isn't working.
Yeah.
But I hope that kind of insight maybe helps people apply it more in the way in which we intended to and just weren't clear enough about.
Well, and I think the fact that... At every point when the numbers were what they were before and what they are now, we have easy, you know, medium, and hard. And the fact that we have a scale is there to suggest to the DM that not only is the DM given the flexibility to pick how hard the challenge is intended to be, but really can adjust the numbers on the fly. So if the challenge is it's way too easy or it's way too hard, DMs just change the numbers on the fly. As Mike said, they're not canonical. Your game isn't going to go up in flames if you decide to tweak the numbers to get the kind of challenge you want for your group.
And keep in mind, it's important to keep in mind that if you're going for a very simple skill challenge with a low number of successes needed, that is going to be easy. You know, it's not going to be much of a challenge. It's really when you're saying you need to rack up like those eight successes that just luck starts coming into play. Like the players rolled a couple twos and flubbed a couple of pretty easy skills. So it is also kind of something where it's more of a long duration sort of thing. If you think of the skill challenge, I think the lowest is four successes to complete a skill challenge. I can't remember off the top of my head. That is like a fight where like the five third level characters kick in the door and there's one third level orc. There's one orc skirmisher on the other side. That's gonna be a very quick fight. You know, the trick is just, well, how much are we gonna take any damage in beating this guy down? You know, so it does kind of help to conceptually think of it that way. That yeah, you know what? If you only need four successes, the party is probably gonna very easily get through that encounter. So, and that's why the XP is lower too. So.
All right, the next question coming from Esper, and I have also seen this one on the message boards asked and sort of answered in a way, but I figured I would ask it here to get your take on it. Healing surges. What exactly is a healing surge? I understand what a healing surge is mechanically, but when my wizard drops to negative 10 hit points because a charging ogre skewers him, how does he spend healing surges, quote-unquote, and recover back? What is he doing to accomplish all of this healing after a seemingly devastating attack?
And that is one of the things that, and I remember learning this lesson back when I ran first edition and having to relearn a little bit in fourth. It really comes down to his DM making sure that you're not overselling the attack. That really, the way you want to think of it is that a healing surge spent represents like an actual wound that you need to kind of recover from. That everything leading up to getting dropped to zero is a nick or a bruise or a near miss or a glancing shot. That I remember this very vividly because I remember sitting around the few times I played at my house, usually played at my friend's house. We're playing, I feel like it was Village of Hamlet, and the ranger is up front fighting some monsters, and there's a couple clerics in the party, and they keep healing him. And I'm doing all these, like, the gnoll drives a spear through your torso of like 12 damage, and your organ. And it's like I was doing these super over the top descriptions of the wounds, and then the clerics would throw the heal spell, and the cure like wounds. And the player's like, wait a sec, this is a little goofy, right? Like, this guy has been eviscerated, chopped in half, decapitated, but we just keep healing. You kind of realize, you have to tone it down. You have to kind of put it in context of all the resources available to the players. So, as DM, what you want to say is like, when the ogre comes around the corner and there's the poor little wizard and he just crushes him, knocks him right to zero, that attack might be the one that you're like, the ogre swings his club at an arc and you hear the sickening thud as it whacks against the wizard's skull and he collapses over. But you don't want something like, it's this massive, and he shatters five of his bones and sends them to... I mean, that might be if you know the players at zero healing surges. Okay, that's when you describe, here's the gruesome injury. Like, he's just broken a limb and this guy's not getting up anytime soon.
Right.
But those intermediate injuries, you want to sort of keep in mind that, okay, now is the part where you've been hurt really badly, where, people notice because you're unconscious. So that's why when you might throw in, the cracked rib, that when the cleric uses healing word mends and things like that, and throw that into your description. So it's really just a matter of learning to gauge how you describe the action in relation to how many healing surges the characters have left.
And also, as a DM, I would sort of look ahead to, when the character is going to get healed, keep in mind the healing abilities that the other characters have at their disposal. So if you can expect that the wizard is going to be healed by a cleric, for example, then you can get a little carried away with describing the damage that the wizard takes. Because if you know the cleric has healing resources left, then the cleric's divine magic is going to knit those wounds back together.
Yeah.
But if you know that the wizard was just dropped, and the wizard, if the wizard is going to get healed back, and we hope the poor wizard is going to be, if the wizard's going to be brought back from the brink by a warlord, well, then temper your description of the wound. Talk about, maybe the wizard was knocked out, not, run through by a spear.
Yeah.
And it is the warlord's inspiring shout that snaps the wizard out of it.
Yeah. If I wanted to give like a canonical, like, this is the reality of what's going on, I would default to the sort of, the warlord can always get you back until you're at zero healing surges. And that's when you've been mauled. You know, so if you if you're just trying to think of, you know what, I don't want to worry about the source of the healing or where things are going, I just default, okay, a warlord could get this guy up.
Right.
So what just happened? Okay, he just got his bell rung, and he's not actually unconscious. He's like on the ground, his eyes rolling back in his skull, and sort of maybe moving a little bit and drooling. But you know, someone gets over there and picks him up and shakes him. He's going to be back. You know, and a little worse the wear, but you know.
I think anyone else growing up in the '80s who watched Hulk Hogan wrestle,
yes, yes, exactly,
clearly visualize him rallying after a beatdown,
and that's
a second wind or a healing surge, or whatever the case may be. This next question coming from Andrew Jackson from the Annals of History, I suppose. Please put to rest, no pun intended, how you intended the sleep spell to work. I have been ruling that it is a forced natural sleep, which is why they get a saving throw, but they can also be woken up by the same means as a natural sleep. However, this makes it a little too easy, as a shout should be able to wake them up.
Do you want to feel this one?
Sure, yeah. So the intention is that it is a magical sleep, so slapping them, even damaging them, is not going to wake them up.
Pulling out a magic marker and writing on their face.
Yeah, yeah. They are
at parties at the
They are staying asleep until either they make that saving, they succeed at that saving throw, or some other power causes that sleep to end.
It's also like, actually, and this is kind of funny, we were talking about this the other day about how we don't want to say, unless we mean for a creature to be immune to attacks that cause sleep, we want to say things are like, oh, the treant doesn't need to sleep, but it can be put to sleep by a sleep spell. And so I try to think of it that way. Like when you throw the sleep spell on the creature that you don't think needs to sleep, just keep in mind this is much more like the Sleeping Beauty sleep than someone just taking a nap. It's you know, I like to think of it almost like it's like fey magic. It's very like
it's a deep magical slumber.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Next few questions are going to be concerning some future products coming out. David Brightbill asks, so far, we have only one controller class, Wizards. What is the next controller class, and what other future controller classes are coming?
We mean the next controller classes, actually.
Yeah, we have several coming up.
PH2, I think they've both been previewed now in Dragon Magazine.
Yes, they have.
We've got, I'll say one, we have the Invoker and...
The Druid.
Let's see where teamwork is. and I think what you're going to see is that the Invoker looks a little like a wizard. And the Druid looks nothing like a wizard.
Okay.
And check out Dragon Magazine for the previews. I mean, I hope I'm not being too much of a shill, but I got a dog to feed. You know, that guy eats a lot.
No. These next questions are all about products, and they're all a little bit of a shill element to them.
Yeah. I think what you're going to see is that it's kind of it's easy to fall into the trap of thinking controllers will all look like the wizard, and some of them will, just like a lot of defenders will look like the fighter. But there is a lot of space we have to do interesting things with those classes and roles. I think the Druid's going to show that off. I hope it shows it off.
Yeah. So. Yeah.
On a related question, Matthew asks, are there any plans for classes based around the creation, summoning, or raising of minions?
Oh.
This is something we've talked about.
There are now. Thank you, Matthew. Keep in mind the ideas you send to us are copyright 2000. Yeah, that's actually something we've talked about a little bit, and I think it's something that would actually be a lot of fun just to play with. I know you've had some ideas, Mr. Crawford, on something exactly like this.
Can I say what my ideas are?
Yeah, go for it.
I'm not saying we are planning on doing this, but we have talked about a variation of the warlord, where the warlord would have several lackeys, as it were, who would run around and fight at his or her command.
The lackey lord.
Yes, the lackey lord.
All right. We have indeed been previewing Player's Handbook 2 in recent weeks on the website. We have not spoken yet about the Dungeon Master's Guide 2. Kenson asks, what kind of rules and essays can we expect to see in the DMG 2? That's perhaps just a little taste of what they're becoming.
Sure. Oh, yeah, of course. I don't know, Jeremy, have you worked on the book at all? I don't know
if not on DMG 2.
Okay, so I'll field this one in full. We are really looking at a big question you look at is what you actually put into a second DMG. There was a DMG 2 for third edition, and I think it did some things right, and I think it did some things not so right. We really want people to feel like with each of the new core rule books, that they're getting something really new and interesting that is going to push their games in a fun new direction if they embrace that option. So I think what you can expect is a book that has a similar structure to the first DMG, expands on some of the advice in there, and takes some of the mechanics in there, like, say, monster creation, and uses those as a starting point to offer new mechanics and more options. So that's probably a good rule of thumb until you guys see the first of, like, the twos, that's kind of what we call them, to sort of expect that. Like, look at the one you have in your hands right now and think, well, if you're going to make a sequel to sort of treat each chapter as its own little book, what would you put in that chapter? I also think generally if we do advice, we're going to acknowledge, well, we've already given you the advice in the first DMG. You know, there aren't too many beginning DMs who are going to pick up DMG 2 first. So we sort of know that's gone before. So we want to try to, like, sort of ramp up the sort of, okay, you've learned this now, or at least you've read it and reacted to it, and however you think, okay, now here's the next layer, you know, deep, you know, new techniques and stuff that's maybe a little more advanced.
Okay, this next question, I'm realizing I am slightly reticent to ask, but if you want to answer yes, no, or cannot say at this time,
okay.
Shadow Elf asks, is there going to be a necromancer class?
Maybe. Hard to say. Jeremy's smiling. Why is Jeremy smiling? Do you know something I don't?
I can't say on air.
Okay.
All right, well,
I would say this. I like necromancers quite a bit. So,
and I will say I like them quite a bit also.
Yeah.
All right, then we'll leave it at that.
Yeah.
I have one more rules question, and then I'm going to go on to a couple of, let's say, obscure questions.
Oh, cool. Okay, I like these.
Alexa asks, if a character falls prone on his turn, can another party member pick him up such that he would no longer be considered prone after that?
Yeah, I guess. Good question. What would you say, Jeremy? I'm going to put you on the spot.
If I were coming up with a ruling on the fly, and hey, I guess I am.
Yeah.
I would treat it like the grabbing rules, where you're essentially grabbing your friend, and we have the rule for moving someone else around as a standard action. I'd probably say, hey, you don't need to actually take an action to grab the person because it's your buddy.
Yeah.
And he'll let you grab him. But probably you need to take the standard action to haul him around.
I'd be a little, well, I think I'd do something similar. I'd probably say a move action just to make him stand.
Mm.
And then I'd probably let you do what else you wanted to. But okay. Yeah, that makes sense too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess I'm being more mean.
You're a meaner DM. I'm a nice DM. I just kill the characters. I don't actually try to mess with them in the rules. Like, of course you can make him stand. And now the head level poison darts shoot out from the walls and hit your friend too.
All right.
Oh, yeah. No, that's the.
Pierce through both of you.
Yeah, pierce through both of you.
Yeah.
But wait, I don't want to mess up the healing search thing. They glance off of you slightly. Yeah. But that's my bloodthirsty side. Oh, it rips right through your eye socket for 2 points of damage. Like, wait, what? Come on, guy. What this? How did that just happen?
Yeah, it's.
Still remember that game. I just went bloodthirsty, I guess.
All right, a couple questions here, a bit on the obscure side. The next one comes from Chris. I ask this because I remember playing this in one of your games, Mike.
Okay.
When will firearms be shown in 4E?
Oh, yeah.
What level of technology could they take?
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting. I had this long, like, this, I remember having this conversation back when I ran against the Giants and I was thinking of guns. And I ran a little playtest. That's right, I ran the playtest. I think that speaking as lead designer, if someone said, "Hey, we want you to do guns in D&D," or if I got a chance to, I think I would. There's always this impulse to, like, go pick up a history book and look at what muskets and all those weird rifles did, and I think I wouldn't do that. I think I would just say, if I'm in a fantasy world, wizards can throw lightning bolts, and I have a gun. What's the gun gonna, like, act like or look like? I think I'd want it to be a little more interesting than that. Like. You know, I like the idea of, like, the ogre carrying around what looks like a cannon that should be on a ship, and he's just blasting away, and there's these goblins, you know, these little goblins crawling around all over it, and he has his backpack, he has the ammo, and the goblins are, like, tossing the ammo back and forth and loading it for him, and he's firing again. You know, I think if I was going to do guns, flavor-wise, that's what I'd go for, like, really magical. Not magical in the sense of arcane power, but, like, whoa, this is a fantasy gun. Like, this is what a dwarf would make if the dwarf was, like, we have these, you know, orc shamans and dragons and stuff. What's our gun going to look like? It's going to be this really big, badass, blow a dragon in half kind of thing. It wouldn't just be a rifle. And I think rules-wise, I think it would be pretty cool to look at, like, you know, what makes a gun feel like a gun compared to, like, a crossbow or a bow. And I'd really want it to feel different. If it's something like, you know, if you played the game, an old game called Space Hulk, like Overwatch, you know, like, you know, if I have a gun, it's much quicker. You know, if you played Left 4 Dead on the Xbox or PC, like, you know, the idea of shooting from the hip, right? You come around the corner, there's a zombie jumps at you, you just start firing blindly. You know, kind of make it, give it that feel where, like, you know, no one really shoots a bow blindly. You get to pull back and aim, same with the crossbow. And so I would try to make it mechanically feel like this is the mechanics and the flavor behind this thing justify its existence compared to a bow or a crossbow.
Yeah. I mean, although I could see us, well, I could see someone doing a sort of more historical style guns. Yeah. If someone wanted to do a low magic game, like they decided, hey, we're going to just have martial classes, like say you want to do a, you know, a swashbuckling game and you have people firing revolvers, I could see that also working really well.
Yeah. Hey, it would depend on the flavor. I was thinking more for like for core D&D. But if I was doing a game like there's an old RPG called Lace and Steel, which was this sort of like, you know, like French Three Musketeers sort of feel, but with a lot of magic and, you know, like satyrs and centaurs and stuff. Then I think, I'd go for like a very, because that would fit that setting.
Right.
Yeah, it sounds like that's the design challenge. It's not a crossbow. It's not a wand.
Yeah.
What differentiates a firearm? Antonio from Chicago asks, this is a small problem for our group because of the realism they try to impose. Can you use a candle to light someone on fire?
I'm just trying to think the physics of actually. So
if you were swinging it around, probably the candle would go out by the time you made contact.
You know, it's funny because if I can go into my personal life for a second,
tell us about the time you set yourself on fire.
No, almost as funny. it was one time in our house, my wife set up some candles for some reason, and the cat set herself on fire on one of the candles. And my dad, the firefighter, like pointed out that we were lucky when the cat burst into flames, or didn't burst into flames, it was smoking and smoldering, she immediately ran into the bedroom and hid under the bed, and luckily the fire went out. But I guess my dad has gone to places where like the cat is caught on fire and has burst into flames and run under the bed and set it on fire and burned down the place. But yeah, I think setting a person on fire with a candle, I can't imagine, like, it's kind of one of those things where it's like, okay, hold still for a while.
Right.
And this is going to hurt, and then maybe if I throw some lighter fluid on you. Yeah,
make sure your sleeve is hanging into the flame.
Yeah, because, I think it would just be, as a DM, if a player said they wanted to do that, I would need some really clever thinking from that player for me to think that's doing anything other than just making people maybe, like, pause and go, what the heck are you doing with that candle? Like, right, I just... Yeah, it's hard to set someone on fire.
Now, a torch...
It's a bit bigger.
That I would go for. I would, especially if like you whack the person with a torch, I'd treat it as an improvised melee weapon.
Yeah, does fire damage.
And maybe if the conditions are good for setting this guy on fire...
He's doused in lamp oil.
Exactly.
Well, that's true. You throw your flask of oil, then touch it up.
And then have it do a modest amount of ongoing fire damage.
Yeah, like 5... 10 or 15, depending on tier or something like that.
Yeah.
But I think you would just, for a candle, I think I'd need some sort of accelerant. I think that's the phrase they use. They being people who talk about fire a lot, pyromaniacs and firefighters.
So, which, for the record, you are not, Mike.
No, I am neither. My dad was a firefighter, but not a pyromaniac.
So bottom line, just use your sword.
Yeah, exactly. A candle? I mean, come on. If this is like a
torch, use your fireball.
Yeah, use your fireball, yes. I just don't see a candle being that useful.
I will say, though, that in our game, anytime there is a fireplace in the room, invariably the monster is getting pushed, pulled, slid into that fireplace.
And that's a big fire. But not a candle.
Okay. Cody, I'm going to paraphrase his question just a bit.
I'm going to edit out all the swears.
We're going to edit those in, actually.
Yeah.
Make it beefier.
Do we need one of those commercial breaks to warn parents that...
this is the explicit portion of the show.
If you hear a lot of beeping.
Yeah.
Now, in our published material, obviously what we're trying to do is publish finished material.
Yeah.
Would you ever considering publishing material that is intentionally mechanically broken with a mind towards illustrating why it is mechanically broken?
Oh, I see what you're saying. So, we're like... Okay, I see. Like, here's a feat, and we're going to show you. Right, like
here's a
example.
Bad feat, but why? And we'll explain to you why.
Exactly.
Or bad Paragon class.
You know, that's actually a pretty good idea. I mean, if we wanted to do something like in Dragon Magazine about like here's stuff you shouldn't do, because I think a lot of times you look at something you should do, and it's like, well, Like, I used to have this when I first started playing Warhammer back in the day. Here's a bunch of really, really nicely painted miniatures. And what I loved, it was like, or like those old how to draw things. Okay, you want to draw this clown. So first draw a circle, that's his nose. Okay, now draw like a line bullet for his mouth. Okay, yeah, and now draw the clown. You know, and it felt that way. Whereas maybe if something like what not to do would be more instructive. You know?
Yeah, show before and after versions of powers. Here's a power before it went into development and editing.
Yeah.
And here it is after.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's interesting.
Well, good question, Cody. We'll put that into the hopper. Let's ask a question. Oh, okay, this is a very, very self-serving question from Mark, who goes by the email Princess Mark.
Nice. As someone who's Pink Daisy on Xbox Live, I can appreciate that.
How long before we get another Penny Arcade and PvP podcast?
Oh, I think this is a question for Bart.
Oh, as a matter of fact, it is. I only ask it because...
Oh, so this was... Oh, I wasn't sure when you said it was self-serving. Oh, who self-serving. It was serving. It's serving you.
Of course. When you ask the questions, you get to have your own agenda here. We did record the next podcast episodes with folks from Penny Arcade and PvP. If you frequent their websites, you know that they have been talking about the game. Will Wheaton was also the guest star in that game. Apparently, he had a lot of fun and has been reporting on that as well. I believe our plan is to break up that podcast into several segments, again with nice original art coming from those folks, starting, I want to say, mid-February and moving up towards the release of Player's Handbook 2.
See, that still blows my mind. Like, I remember going to PAX in 05 and, like, you know, it's just funny to think, like, whoa, those guys play my game now, you know? Yeah. You know, Will Wheaton plays the game. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, anyone plays a game I worked on. Other than my friends who I'm, you know, forced to play games I made back in the day.
Yeah, it's a
great
feeling.
It still blows my mind, yeah.
All right, let's ask a question from Ben, who wants to know what is the best way to kill a ranger.
Oh.
The monsters in my game are being mercilessly slaughtered by this guy, and I feel it's time for some revenge.
It's an elf ranger, W. It's a drow ranger, triple. Ugh, no offense to Mr. Salvatore.
He goes on, I've tried lurkers, but they can't hit his AC or reflex. Immobilizing effects don't seem to help me much either. I'm fairly stuck on what to do. He's a level 6 elven ranger, by the way, wielding a longbow with deadly effect.
So a lot of it comes down to what else is in the party. If you have a fighter, the fighter makes life difficult for a DM who wants to kill a character.
Not that we would ever advocate DMs trying to kill their player characters.
Oh, especially their players, because that's customers. But no, I think the best way, speaking as someone who's played a number of range guys, is any terrain that cuts down my line of sight. As actually, I killed the first official 4th edition character. Like, I think the game was in a form that was recognizably 4th at that point. And the first character I killed was a ranger, killed by another player character inadvertently. But so to give you a sense of what happened, the party goes into this room, there's some goblins there, and it's a pretty large room, and there are these thick tapestries that hang along the walls. And so the party goes bustling in, and the ranger walks into the door and steps to the right and starts, you know, ventilating goblins, and the rest of the party charges forward. And the poor ranger, what he did not realize was that lurking behind the curtain, directly behind him, was a bugbear strangler. So anytime you can use terrain to get a monster of right next to an archer, especially a tasty little monster like the Strangler who can hit someone and hold them down in place, that's a pretty good way to kill off an archer.
Yeah. Well, and really any kind of lurker.
Yeah.
It's a great way to have a monster or two separated away from the other monsters and sneak up on the archer or the wizard or whoever else is hanging in the back of the party.
Yep. Use some terrain to get them close where they can see them. Lurkers with a real strong control element. I mean, that's one of the tempting things might be, well, let's find the guy who does the most damage and just kill this guy in one shot. But I think for archer types, it's the control guy that really hoses them. If you have a guy who's like, I'm going to immobilize you and I'm going to keep the fighter away, so I'm getting opportunity attacks against you when you're trying to fire back, I'm throwing, you know, I'm dazing you, I'm stunning you, that is the stuff that's going to stop a character like that cold. So good luck. Good hunting.
And I have seen that in games as well. You don't want the archer to essentially become the auto-turret from Aliens.
Yes.
Right, where he's just set up and he's firing into melee.
Great movie. Good reference. Good reference.
Robert has a question. We're going to call this Pimp My Campaign arc. I have been playing and DMing for 8 years, and for the most part, I haven't been enjoying it. However, I'm going to paraphrase a bit again. He is trying to avoid a campaign where you essentially clear a dungeon.
Yes.
He would rather attempt a campaign where the characters are wrongfully accused convicts on the run. I'm giving them a few clues and no real suggestions on how to unravel the conspiracy, but my concern is that they will end up getting captured time and again or simply getting bored. Hearing this campaign arc idea, what things would you suggest to keep my adventure idea from becoming stale?
Do you want to take a crack at this one first, or I don't want to talk all the way through this thing?
Well, I mean, you could look at a story like The Fugitive for ideas where not only, I'm thinking of the film version, so I'll refer to Harrison Ford. Not only is he on the run and has, you know, various scrapes with his pursuers, but like any good D&D campaign, the story makes use of a lot of interesting locations. You know, I'm thinking of there's the scene at the dam, and there's the scene early on in the bus. And so even if you're going to do a campaign filled with, you know, chases across the countryside and hopefully through city streets and maybe through, you know, tight village alleyways, you can also have times where the chase pauses because, you know, perhaps the characters are looking for clues about their pursuers or a way to end this chase once and for all in various dungeon locations. Maybe they hear about some benevolent king or queen and they try to find this ruler and seek out their help and then maybe get sidetracked by helping them with whatever political mess is going on in their kingdom. So there, I mean, one of the great things about a chase structure is there are all sorts of things you can throw in the party's path. You know, again, not only from pursuers, but to, you know, very interesting locations and forcing them to then figure out what the heck do we do about this tornado that just hit us or whatever it is.
The I have two suggestions. The first one, there is a TV show called Jailbreak. I think it's on Fox. And I want to say in the third season...
Prison Break.
Prison Break. Yeah, there you go. Attention. Jailbreak's an AC/DC song. But the... good one, too. I love AC/DC. But the... I think you might want to check out that show. I think it's the third season where essentially the characters in the first two seasons, as the show would... As the title might suggest, go to jail and break out. You know, sort of wrongly convicted kind of thing. And I think in the third season, they sort of uncover this conspiracy that was behind getting them in prison in the first place. So they're fugitives on the run. I think it's almost exactly what you're talking about. They're fugitives on the run, trying to take down this conspiracy that controls the government while not getting caught. So you might want to check out some episodes of that for some inspiration. Another kind of fun thing to do, too, would be to really, to kind of play off what Jeremy was talking about, take a very open-ended approach to the campaign. Like, put down a map of the campaign area for the PCs and kind of let them know, okay, well, here's the city where there's a lot of guards and people know that you're on the run. But here on the hinterlands, here on the edges and the borderlands and stuff, people don't really, you know, that's kind of like where you go if you don't want to deal with the government or the king and stuff. So you kind of give the players a sense of, okay, well, let's go here because we know no one knows us there. And then you want to layer on top of it things like, well, let's go here because no one knows us there. And that's where, like, the magistrate's summer home is. And that's, we want to get that guy and figure out what's going on. And the nice thing with that structure, and I ran something similar way back when I ran first edition, I had a character who was in a very similar situation. He was on the run, wrongly accused of a crime. And I had a lot of fun doing things where it's like, okay, you're safe here on the edge of the kingdom. No one really knows who you are. But now you need to go back into the city because you figured out, hey, like, you know, go back to my earlier example. You grab the magistrate, force him to tell you what's going on. You realize, oh, we need to implicate the Duke behind this scheme or something like that, which means we have to go back into the city, so we have to disguise ourselves. You talked about, like, you don't want the characters getting caught all the time. That's actually a pretty convenient hook because if the players ever lose a fight, they just get captured, and then you get to run the jailbreak scenario. Or, you know, and I think you can have some fun with things, you know, doing that, of come up with, just ahead of time, you know, think of some really imaginative, you know, dungeons the players might be thrown into, just in dungeons in the sense of a jail. You know, like, what are some weird, like, you know, in a fantasy world, what does a jail look like? What's a prison look like? There was, I think, Brian Aldiss, a British fantasy author, had this... this trilogy of science fiction novels, and there was this kind of like a prison slash, you know, place for like a monastery almost, where picture a mountain, and carved at the mountain is this large ring, like a 10-foot-wide passage, it's like miles and miles long. And in it, imagine a train of these little cells on wheels that rotate along this this thing, where you take someone, if they're a prisoner, you throw them into, and there's only one doorway that's like one cart wide, you throw a prisoner into the cart, and the prisoners slowly pull themselves through this mountain, and it might be like a few years before they actually come out the other side, and then they're taken out. You know, and then there's like a system to get food into them and stuff, and that might be like a weird kind of dungeon. The players start out, okay, they're stuck in these cells moving, well, how do they get out, you know, and well, they find, you know, like there's a secret door one day, and the passages have been carved, and it's actually this ancient prison built like hundreds of years ago by some other, you know, forgotten race and stuff.
Yeah, there's a great, brings to mind a good movie. I think it's called The Cube.
Yes, you know, yeah, yeah.
It's a science fiction prison. They have no idea what's in the next room. Could be a trap, could be an adversary, an ally.
Yeah. So that makes it where you make up a couple of locations like that as your backup. Okay, what happens if they do get captured? And then run your campaign, and maybe the players need to go in there and break someone out and stuff like that. So
And yet another thing you can try out, and this is, this is an idea from the Bourne Identity trilogy, where again you have a character who's constantly being pursued, and you know he starts out really isolated, but something that happens in that story, and this happens in other stories about people being pursued, is over time, the player characters can learn of or meet NPCs who are slowly getting it, are discovering that, these people were wrongly accused. And then those NPCs start pursuing the PC's pursuers.
Yeah.
And then that's a way to give the player characters some relief. There, you know, people can come to help them. But then you introduce additional dramatic tension, because then something might happen to those NPCs who are trying to help the player characters. And so then you can have a whole portion of the campaign based on then trying to protect or save these people who are trying to protect or save the player characters.
Or, like betrayal or something like that. You know, the innkeeper, his daughter is held hostage, so he has to betray the PCs and things like that. And it's a really good campaign idea. Yeah. I think there's a lot of depth there. So,
okay, I have but two questions left. And these ones, one sort of leads into the other. Andrew is a recent graduate, Bachelor's of Science in Games and Art and Design.
Cool.
And essentially he's asking if he's interested in a career in game development, what next steps could he take? This is a question that does get asked a lot. We might have even answered it before, but again, it comes up again and again. If you are interested in working for the gaming industry, what can you do?
Well, I only have experience into the sort of the analog side of things. I don't know much about the digital end, but there's a lot of obvious stuff I'm sure you've heard before, like, you know, play a lot of games, play games critically, you know, understand why games work the way they do.
And play many different kinds of games.
Yeah,
I mean, even if you want to primarily work in role-playing games, still play board games, card games, computer games, just to see what the state of the art is in game design.
A good rule of thumb I like to think of is just, you know, and it's kind of cliche if you're in the business, but think someone's at some point is going to ask you, what's your favorite game? And then they're going to ask you why. And if you can give a good answer to that, that's a good starting point. Now, on the other end, actually getting experience, because there's always nothing like experience, right? I mean, that's the kind of kick in the teeth. You could have this great insight, but when people look at your resume, they want to see experience. So for tabletop side of things, probably these skills might be a little more important than in the digital side of design, but since we use a written medium, you want to try to get your writing skills up to speed. You know, a good place to start is just by reading a lot. I actually feel like Ursula Le Guin wrote a really cool trilogy of fantasy books, the Earthsea Trilogy. It's a young adult series, but I think the writing there was very nice. I try to read stuff that I think is like a little bit over my head style-wise, so I can kind of learn how to write better. And really just for Wizards of the Coast in particular, submitting articles to Dragon and Dungeon, you know, that's a really good place to start. Start small, you know, and then slowly build from there. Just keep submitting things. I mean, the nice thing about doing like a 2,000-word article, let's say a couple Paragon paths or just some new powers, you can write that, send it in, and if it gets rejected, it probably, you know, a lot of stuff you write freelance like that's going to get rejected. It's just the nature of the business. You haven't put so much time into it, and you can sort of process that, learn from it, move on to the next one, and just kind of keep plugging away at it. And also, just in general, I look for internships. I know like I don't know where you live, but I know like around in Seattle, there's a lot of game companies that do digital games, and I'm sure they have internships. They're always looking for new people. If you have a PC, if you're a PC gamer, look at, you know, designing levels for games like, and I'm going to show my age here with respect to PC games, but like I know Quake and Doom back in the day, level editors and stuff, user-generated content. That's really doing design work. You know, if you can design a cool map that people like, or even just the practice, you know, you don't have to like release it and have a million people download it and love it. I mean, you might just make your map or whatever and no one's downloading it, but when you show it to someone you're applying to a job for, they're going to see, you know, what you're capable of doing.
And if your interest is primarily D&D or other tabletop role-playing games, I mean, one of the best things you can do to hone your skills is to DM.
Yeah.
And ask your players to give you critical feedback and to constantly push yourself to come up with more and more interesting encounters, stronger stories, come up with new ways to engage your players and let them be your critics.
Yeah. It's a good starting point. The tricky thing to become a pro, I think, from being a... Because really what we are, we're just almost professional dungeon masters.
Right.
But we just write content for everyone in the world.
Yeah.
You know, not just at one table. And that, I think, is the tricky transition going. Because if you know, you really know your audience when you're DMing for your friends. We don't know our audience. We kind of have a general, you know, in terms of marketing data and stuff, but we don't know them as people. So being of the right stuff for essentially strangers that they find compelling is a big hurdle for any creative area.
Yeah. And I mean, at least in our medium, you know, we employ illustrators, cartographers, editors, and for all of those areas, there are certain baseline skills you need to have, whether you're working in the game industry or any other industry. So if you want to be a game editor, you just need to get the skills that all editors have, similarly with being a cartographer, for example.
And one final thing, especially for D&D, it helps know the history of the game. You know, you should be familiar with, like, the basics of first edition, the classic adventures like Tomb of Horrors, the Giant series. You know, there is a lot of culture behind the game. And so knowing that, knowing play styles, you know, don't just look at the current D&D stuff, but know the old stuff too, because that is the foundation of how we got here.
And also see how the game has evolved from edition to edition and try to understand why it's evolved in the way it's evolved.
Yep.
And then also to see the common threads.
Yeah.
Okay, good advice. And the final question kind of follows up on that. Mike, you have fallen into my trap, as I hoped you would. Speaking of submitting to Dragon and Dungeon magazines, JL asks, essentially, what type of articles would you be interested in seeing submitted for Dragon and Dungeon magazines? Now, not to put you guys too much on the spot, but considering your knowledge of forthcoming products and what's coming down the road, might you have a topic or two that you would pitch out there that goes beyond that, that you wouldn't mind seeing in the magazines, that maybe R&D isn't tackling, but you could see having a place in the game?
You know, for me, my personal sweet spot, well, the first rule of thumb would be, if you're excited about the article and your players want that thing you're writing, that's a great sign.
Yeah.
But I know a thing that I love to see in the magazines is, groups of powers for any class that have a thematic link. Like, here are 15 necromancer spells for the wizard. Here's a couple of at-wills. Here's a bunch of encounter powers. This is going to let you feel like you're playing a necromancer. That is very fertile ground. This is the nature of the power system right now that we're not, you know, we're going to be covering slowly but surely, but that's a great, that kind of article I love. Yeah, and for any class, you know, you want to make the knight, well, here's how to make your fighter into a knight. Here's the powers that make him feel like this valiant, you know, chivalrous knightly guy.
And maybe along with some feats that support that.
Yeah.
I would love to see some more creative presentations of skill challenges.
Yeah.
You know, see skill challenges used for, you know, a medieval style fair, you know, do a skill challenge to have a joust. You know, there are all sorts of, there's a lot of gold there that hasn't been mined yet.
And I'd say for dungeon, and I'd be sure my answer, I haven't looked at dungeon in a bit, so I might be behind the times a little bit, but I would love to see an adventure that's a little more like what we call sort of sandboxy, where it's just like, here's like a dungeon. Here's just a level of a dungeon. And there's some cool seats. Here's some NPCs that are interesting and some factions, but it's really up to the players and player going to create the story. And on the opposite end of it, I'd love to see like just an entire adventure that's just non-combat. You know, just a series, like, here is the adventure, which is go to this masquerade ball at this noble's house and find the assassin before he kills the baron.
With again, a lot of skill challenge goodness.
Intrigue. And things that challenge, like, the players will come up with a good plan, you know? And just sort of think, well, looking at what we know of these guys, who do we think could have killed? Oh, well, let's put together this clue, and know, oh, it's this guy, you know? Stuff like that. So, yeah, those are things I'd like to see.
And it sounds like potentially an article on firearms.
Yeah, exactly. It's like ogres and goblin loaders and stuff.
Okay, well, that is the end of my questions. So thank you both for participating in our latest podcast.
Thanks for joining Bart, Jeremy, and I in this week's podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed it. As usual, the podcast is available through the Wizards website at wizards.com and through iTunes. If you have any rants, raves, or other feedback, it's dndinsider@wizards.com. And I hope you enjoy the podcast, and keep playing D&D, and don't be afraid to send in more questions. I'm sure we'll do another mailbag. That's always a fun... I always love answering the questions. It's a good time. All right, take it easy, guys, and good gaming.